mirror leaf.
Nanagal completed his survey of the damage this morning,
Emali told the Thane, as all five of them stood on the steps of the Orinthian.
How long until you resume meetings?
He's confident his people will have it back in order in a month.
A month? Are you certain it wouldn't be better to have the mirror leaf?
The Fane's comment lost confidence when facing Imali's growing frown. The curator, still sporting a cast on her leg and a sling on her arm, had a way of cowing everyone with her disapproval, even Lothian.
I know you mean well, she told him, but given the circumstances, I think it would be wise to follow traditional roles and allow the Elwyn to handle the restoration. I think the Orinthian has seen enough of the Miralith's art for a while.
A month, he repeated.
The stairs and the plaza continued to bear the scars of battle. Scorch marks blackened the nearby walls, and the eastern steps were still missing. The paint in the market that had looked so much like blood had been cleaned up. An ancient tree was gone from the plaza, but the remaining stump still smelled of sawdust. To one side of the gathered group, the deer in the fountain had yet to be repaired. Its severed stone legs were all that remained. Weeks had passed since the revolt. The days had flown, blurred in a smear of anxiety. Mwandule had lost weight. A lot of people had. Imali looked thinner, too, and paler.
"We are Frey," Imali said. "We do things slowly."
"It's just frustrating." The Fane frowned. "I want it cleaned up. I want this whole episode erased and forgotten, so we can move on."
The curator of the Aquila gave him a strained smile.
"I believe that is exactly what the surviving members of the Aquila and the tribes they serve are afraid of, my Fane. These scars serve to remind the Miralith of the need for restraint, so they don't want this particular corpse buried too soon."
Wanderlei's father scowled, but nodded just the same.
"How bad is it inside?"
The Thane began to climb the steps, and everyone followed, including the giant Sile and the other one, the girl whose name he still couldn't remember. She was short and ugly. Not claw-your-own-eyes-out ugly. Not even rune ugly. But revolting enough that Mwandulay didn't bother remembering her name. She was supposed to be a gifted artist. The word he kept hearing was fast. Apparently, Miss What's-Her-Name had been in the plaza the day of the attack and done something right.
"Not as bad as it could have been."
Imali allowed her sight to focus on Mwandulay. The Fane saw it too, and acted as if he had forgotten his son was there.
"Oh, right."
Mwandulay waited until his father looked away, before frowning and shaking his head ever so slightly. Miss What's-Her-Name was the talk of Estramnadon, but he, Mwandulay, who had saved the most important landmark in the city, and the lives of most of the Aquila, was lauded with such lofty praise as, "Oh, right." Mwandulay turned to discover that the girl had seen his reaction.
"Tiny little hobgoblin sees everything."
"Any news from Rulin?"
Imali asked.
"Not yet," the Fane replied,
taking care to avoid a shattered step.
"I am told such things require preparation, and that the Instaria have yet to begin culling the rune horde."
He gestured around them.
"Apparently that tribe shares the same lightning-fast response to my decrees as the Elwyn."
Imali nodded with that same stoic calm she always used when speaking to his father. Mwandulay imagined she was making an assortment of lewd mental gestures.
"I hear there are something close to 1,000,000 runes," she said. "Mindless but dangerous animals, it seems. Perhaps you should have addressed their numbers centuries ago, before they took root. Now it will take years to exterminate them."
"My Fane," a voice called from behind them. Everyone turned to see Vasek, frozen in mid-step at the bottom of the stairs. His mouth was open, his eyes locked. He held one hand up, a finger pointing toward the sky. Dressed all in grey, he could have been a new statue.
"Really? Sign?" Lothian said. "He's a trusted advisor."
"Which is why he's not dead, Your Greatness," the hobgoblin explained. "Sign, that is her name."
"Release him."
"As you wish."
Vasek stumbled, sighed, and adjusted his assegai before resuming his climb up the stairs.
"My Fane."
He gave a tentative glance at Sign.
"I have news."
"What is it?"
Vasek looked at the others and hesitated.
"It's not good, my Fane."
Montelet's father frowned. He turned to face Imali and sighed.
"See they clean this up."
With that, the Fane and Vasek marched back down the stairs, followed by Sile and Sign, the giant and the hobgoblin. Imali turned to Moinduley.
"What do you think it is?"
He shrugged.
"Probably nothing. Vasek jumps at shadows all the time, even more often as of late."
"With good reason, don't you think?"
Imali adjusted the sling on her shoulder. Moinduley couldn't be certain if this was meant to illustrate her point, or if she was merely uncomfortable. Moinduley always had to be wary of her. Imali often used insinuations that he didn't always understand. This was partly why he found speaking to her interesting. Their conversations were little puzzles to work out. There were times, after concluding a talk, that he went home, thought about it, and realized he'd gotten the discussion all wrong.
"I don't know. Maybe."
Moinduley didn't like being too definitive. He loathed revealing a position, fearing it would be the wrong one. Somehow, he had managed to impress the curator of the Aquila, who so often impressed everyone else, and he very much enjoyed having someone respect him. Moinduley feared opening his mouth and ruining everything.
"Aren't you curious?"
Imali tilted her head toward the Fane, who was crossing the square, heading back toward the Talwara, with Vasek whispering into his ear.
"Not really. Still angry at him?"
Moinduley didn't answer. She continued to stare. Imali wasn't going to let this go.
"He sided with Vidar,"
Moinduley said. Not because he felt he couldn't avoid answering, but because he wanted to. He was angry, and wanted to voice his outrage, even if it might mean appearing petty or childish.
"Don't you think Vidar deserved some compensation? The Frey was nearly executed for something he didn't do. It's still embarrassing. I saved the whole building and everyone in it, and my reward is expulsion."
"You weren't expelled."
"Replaced. It's the same thing."
"No, it's not, and you know it.
Besides, would you have wanted Vidar as your senior again? To go back to being the junior counselor?"
Moinduley shook his head. He hadn't thought of that. The idea sickened him.
"There you are. It wasn't a career for you, just a learning experience. And I'd say you learned a great deal. More than your father ever intended. What's more, you endeared yourself to the Aquila. They won't forget your heroism. Most owe you their lives. And when you become Fane, you'll discover that goodwill to be invaluable."
Imali sat down on the steps, taking care not to bang her arm. Sitting there wasn't unusual. Many Frey sat on the stairs that led to the Arinthian, enjoying the view it afforded of the plaza and the river. Some even picnicked or taught classes there, taking advantage of the natural amphitheatre it created. Wanderlei just found it odd that she would sit there. The difficulty Amali had in getting up and down more than validated his sense that such an act wasn't natural for her.
"When you think of it," Amali said, "leaving the Aquila is the best thing that could have happened. You made friends that day, and now you won't have the opportunity to lose them."
Wanderlei looked at her, stunned on multiple levels. First, he wasn't aware of having any friends, except perhaps Imali herself, and he felt presumptuous for even having the thought. The day after the rebellion, Wanderlei had hidden himself away, terrified of seeing anyone who had been in the Arinthian that day. He was certain they hated him. After all, he had been the one who invited Macareta. Second, if he did have these phantom friends, why would he risk losing them by staying? She must have noticed his expression because she added,
"Right now, you're a hero, and everyone will remember you that way. But if you stayed a member of the Aquila, well, familiarity erodes pedestals. Eventually, you'd be on the wrong side of an argument. We all are at some point, and your legend would diminish. This way, Wanderlei, savior of the Aquila, will remain frozen in everyone's minds, pristine and perfect. What more could a future fane want?"
He smiled and sat down beside her. The old lady had a way of making things seem better. He felt bad about her arm, the way she clutched it.
"I can fix that for you."
Her eyes widened, and she leaned back.
"No, thank you."
She caught herself and took a breath.
"I mean, that's very generous, but I'm old-fashioned. I prefer to let nature take its course." "You're just scared."
She raised her brows, and with her good hand, Imali indicated the devastation of the battlefield memorial around them.
"Absolutely. I was offering to fix your arm, not challenging you to combat. And I wasn't rebuking you, but I'm aware of the inherent complications that can result from taking shortcuts."
They looked down at the market. Only a few of the vendors had returned. Those that were brave enough to do so had little business. People had shifted most of their shopping to stands along the greenway. Since the battle, Florella Plaza had become a haunted place, fit only for ghosts. Mondelet's sight was naturally pulled to a familiar spot where once stood a stand that sold outlandish paintings, melodramatic landscapes of the frontier, created by those with imagination rather than first-hand knowledge.
"Did they find her?" Imali asked.
Mondelet continued to stare at the empty square, at the sawdust and the rubble.
"No. Not that I've heard." "Have you looked?"
"No."
"You liked her?"
"A lot of people liked her. Then she went insane and tried to kill my father. That has a tendency to change things."
"But you still want to see her?"
"She's probably dead."
Saying the words was harder than he would have thought, and afterward he swallowed twice.
"They never found a body."
He looked at Imali then.
"Mirilith don't always leave bodies."
He anticipated awe, or perhaps fear. Instead, Imali appeared amused.
"Such the expert in magical combat now, are we? I went to Rulin with Grindel. Was there when he dueled Arion.
That wiped the smile from her face. But once again, she failed to respond with the awe and fear he deserved. Imali looked concerned in a maternal sort of way, worry creasing her brow.
Was it awful?
Mandalay nearly laughed.
It was amazing. Grindel was such a master. I miss him.
Imali didn't say anything for a moment, then asked,
So, how's the new tutor?
What?
Your father was just telling me about his desire for you to resume your studies. I thought you already had.
Mandalay was aghast.
I have to go.
He stood up.
Mandalay.
She raised a hand to stop him. He reached down and pulled her up.
Thank you.
Mandalay started to turn, but she held on to him.
No, I mean thank you for everything,
she said in a soft voice. And then she leaned over and kissed him on the cheek. A month ago he would have recoiled. A month ago he would have scrubbed his face with a bristle brush. But a month ago he'd never served in the Aquila, nor held up a building while a rebellion raged around him. A month ago he didn't have the respect of one of the highest-ranking officials in the city. Now, as he trotted down the steps, he smiled. Mandalay stormed onto the East Palace balcony, where his father, Vasek, Vidar, and Tarine were holding an impromptu meeting in the summer sun. The senior officer of the Lion Corps stood awkward and stiff, his helm under one arm, listening intently as Vasek droned on about something.
I've just learned I'm to have a new...
This was all Mandalay got out before he was blown onto his back.
Sign, that's my son!
The Fane barked, without nearly enough conviction or outrage to suit Mandalay.
I don't think he's here to kill me.
Mandalay lay moaning. The floor of the Talwara was tiled in marble, and he'd landed on one hip and an elbow.
Oh, get up, boy. She hit you with wind, not a bolt of lightning.
Mandalay crawled to his feet and sneered at Sine. She'd lost interest in him, dismissed him as no one of importance. If he returned the blow, she'd fly off the balcony and into the Shannara River, if she was lucky. He considered it, even chose the sounds and movements which would be required to summon a good strong gust, but his father's voice was already raised, and Mandalay had another, more pressing issue. Still, he was embarrassed, and more than a little angry to be knocked on his backside by a diminutive goblin girl, whom he hadn't heard of until after the Grey Cloak revolt. He also felt the fight to be unfair. He hadn't heard the attack. He'd had no warning, and as a result, no time to defend himself. Thinking about it, he hadn't heard her freeze Vasek either, and she'd been just behind Mandalay at the time. She's fast. That's all there is to it. The girl is fast, and apparently silent.
Call a general assembly of the Shadi, his father told Vasek, and let Casimir know I want to see him.
Shadi,
Mandalay said, coming to the balcony on the side that was opposite Sine.
Why assemble the general army? We have the Instaria.
Alon Rist has been taken, the Thane said. We'll need to reform the Spider Corps. It's been too long since the Miraluth went to war.
Alon Rist was...
Mandalay was certain he hadn't heard correctly, or that his father had misspoken. He sometimes did. Old people had dusty minds that didn't always work right. They forgot where they put things, called people by the wrong names, and while they could remember an incident from 1,000 years ago with perfect clarity, they had no idea what they had eaten for breakfast that morning. His father had once called him traitor, mixing him up with his servant of all people.
"Clean the wax from your ears, boy," his father growled. The runes surrounded the fortress and took it.
But that's not possible. They're just runes,
Mandalay protested.
Ruins led by Nephron and Arion, I suspect.
The Thane looked at Vasek. Vasek nodded.
Information is still coming in. What we know is that thousands of runes, both Gula and Rulan, swept up from the south and surrounded Granford. Within hours, the Instaria Guard surrendered.
The Instaria don't surrender, Mondale said. Those people are fanatical about combat.
You visited them once, and now you're the expert, are you?
His father shook his head.
Nephron is the son of their tribal leader, Taranay said. After all those years of isolation on the frontier, it's possible the Instaria's loyalty tipped more toward one of their own and away from your father.
The door at the end of the corridor opened with a bang and immediately slammed shut again. Cries of pain were followed by unintelligible cursing.
"My Thane!" Hatteras called out. "Let them in, Sign," the Thane told her.
An instant later, the door swung free. Hatteras and Rigorous entered, one tall and the other short. The two were almost always together, usually drinking. Neither was Miralith, so Mondelez knew no more about them than their faces and names.
"You sent for us, my Thane?"
Hatteras asked. His voice was muffled as he rubbed his cheek where the door had hit it.
"We have a problem," the Thane explained. "I ordered the Instaria to invade Rulin and destroy the runes. Instead, Nephron has yoked them into his service, and just like he did with the Greycloaks, he's managed to seduce the Instaria to revolt against me. He's taken control of Alan Rist."
Both Frey returned blank faces, as if they had only understood every other word. Since they weren't Miralith, Mondelez wasn't surprised. His father would likely need to draw pictures.
"What do you want us to do, my Thane?" Hatteras asked.
"The son of my challenger has stolen my army. He has my fortress, and I suspect he's bent on revenge. What do you think I want? We are going to war, you fools. I want an army of my own. Hatteras, you'll raise and command the Bear Legion. Rigorous, the Wolf."
Both men looked terrified.
"Our people will be no match for the Instaria in combat," Hatteras said. "We aren't certain the Instaria have agreed to break Feral's law,"
Vasek added.
"The Greycloaks had no such concern," the Thane shot back,
harshly enough to surprise even Vasek.
His father's advisor nodded, conceding the point, but added, "I just mean that, as warriors, they place a high value on entering Elysian. This may be enough to deter them."
"It doesn't matter," the Thane said. "I am also reinstating the Spider Corps. Casimir Dell will lead them."
The Thane waited for a response from Hatteras and Rigorous. When none came, he added,
"You and your troops will be mostly for show, support, and clean up. The Spider Corps will do the heavy work."
They both nodded, but looked even less confident than before.
"This needs to be stopped and quickly," the Thane said. "I want it over. There will be no half measures. No one is exempt. I want 2,000 ready to march by spring."
2,000? Hatteras looked shocked. "By spring?" Taranay said.
"Is that a problem?" the Thane asked.
Taranay looked to Vasek with desperate eyes.
"We left the defense of Erevan to the Instaria. We only have the Lion Corps and the Shardi on this side of the Nidwalden. Even combined, they aren't much of an army, and training new recruits takes time."
"You have until spring."
"What do we need an army for?" Mondelez said. "We are Miralith."
"So, what would you do, boy? Wish them out of existence? You have that kind of power, do you?"
His father was more than angry. He bordered on rage.
Can you snap your fingers and make thousands of people who are hundreds of miles away, vanish? Did your idol Grindel teach you this miracle during your 2-week jaunt to Rulin? The same trip where he got his head chopped off? I'm seeing a bit of a problem with your council.
Wanderlei was so shocked by his father's tone that he took 2 steps backward, bumping into Sile. His father had never spoken to him like that before. He rarely raised his voice, and Wanderlei found himself frightened that Lothian might lose control and do something he wouldn't regret until later. If then. The Fane walked to the balcony and leaned on the railing. He stared down for several minutes. No one else moved or spoke. Wanderlei imagined that even the songbirds went silent for fear of further angering the Fane. At last, Lothian turned.
Tarrinay.
My Fane?
The phrase snapped to attention.
You will make me a new army. The members of your Lion Corps will train the new recruits for the Bear and Wolf Legions. You will inform Minister Metis regarding your needs for weapons and armor. Let her know this is now her tribe's top priority. By spring, I will have 2,000 trained and equipped warriors ready to march west. Is that understood?
Yes, my Fane,
everyone replied.
With luck, they won't be needed. But luck hasn't been on my side recently.
The others filed out quickly, eager to get to work, or just happy to get away. Wanderlei was left alone with his father, Sile, and Sine. He wished they would leave too, but, of course, they wouldn't. He hadn't seen the Fane's double shadows leave his side since the attack.
Why are you still here? What do you want?
Wanderlei remembered about the news of the tutor, but it was trivial now.
I want to go,
he said, before even thinking.
Go? Go where? With you. When the army is ready, you'll be leading it, won't you?
The Fane narrowed his eyes and stared at his son as if Wanderlei had changed colours or spun his head around in a complete circle.
Yes, he replied. How did you know that?
Just makes sense. You sent Arion, and she failed.
Sent Grindel and me, and we failed. You sent the giants, and they failed.
You want it done right this time.
His father was nodding.
I want to go.
Why?
He considered explaining his desire for revenge for his idol's death, but then reconsidered. His father would most likely think he should be his son's idol, so Wanderlei took another tack.
The Freyd don't go to war often. If I'm to be Fane one day, I should see it, understand it. Your mother took you to the Battle of Maedor when you were young. That's why you know how to deal with this. If I don't go, if I miss the chance to experience battle, how will I know how to handle my own future conflicts?
His father studied him, as if baffled by what he'd just heard. He glanced out the window, then back at his son.
Admirable. You do understand that if you were to stay here, and I were to be killed on the field of battle, you'd be Fane, the youngest one ever, assuming you won against whomever blew the horn in challenge. Going with me is risky. You could die.
I'm not afraid.
No.
I can see that.
I suppose you're too young to worry about death. It's not even a possibility in your mind. Or, if it is, you see your end as some heroic accomplishment and take pleasure in cementing your place in history.
Lothian rubbed his hands together, palm sliding against palm.
Getting older, Wanderlei, is like climbing a mountain. The higher you go, the greater the view. From time to time you look back. At such heights, you can see paths behind you, the trails you took, and the ones you foolishly disregarded. The blind alleys you fortunately missed, purely out of chance, rather than by some greater wisdom on your part.
You also spot others following you, people making the same stupid decisions.
From your elevated position, you witness their bad choices, the ones they can't see because they aren't standing where you are. You could shout down, attempt to warn them, but they rarely listen. They are too blinded by the indisputable fact that the path you followed got you where you are, to the place they want to be.
His father stared, then, as if waiting for a reply, but Mandalay had no idea what his father had been babbling about. Maybe he wasn't saying anything. Dusty-minded, after all. Older people just talked, sometimes. Maybe hearing their own voice was reassuring to them somehow.
"Yes, you can come,"
the Thane said at last, sounding disappointed.
"You too can go to war."
Wanderlei smiled.
"But you'll be precious little use to me without an education."
The smile vanished.
"I've enrolled you at the Academy of the Art."
Thinking his father had appointed a new tutor was bad enough, but this was out of the question.
"The Academy,"
Mandalay said, stunned.
"But that's for... I'm the prince. I don't belong in a public school." "That's exactly where you belong."
The Thane took a step toward his son.
"You need a formal education in the art. And tutors haven't been working out well for you.
Or them."
"But at the Academy?"
Mandalay was horrified at being forced to practice, to take more stupid lessons, and this time in front of an audience.
"How can I... your son attend art school? That's so... wrong." "Wrong? You do know about the Academy, right?"
Mandalay rolled his eyes.
"I know it's no place for the son of the Thane."
Lothian laughed.
"You are aware of how the school came to be."
Mandalay thought a moment. This was one of those things he felt he ought to know, but for some reason he couldn't recall if he'd ever learned that particular fact. By the way his father was acting, Mandalay had missed something important. He gave up.
"No."
His father let out a small huff that Mandalay couldn't translate. He didn't sound upset, but he didn't sound thrilled either.
If anything, the Thane appeared mildly amused. "The school was founded by Pyridion."
Mandalay stared at his father, who stared back with enough expectation in his eyes to make Mandalay nervous.
"Oh, by the face of Feral, you have no idea what I'm talking about, do you?"
Mandalay slowly shook his head. He didn't like it that Sile and Sine were listening. Not that he cared about Sile. The giant didn't look capable of understanding which object in the sky was the sun and which was the moon. Sine was another matter. Mandalay didn't want to look stupid in front of her, and he felt he was doing just that.
But what did it really matter if he didn't know who founded the Miralith Art Academy? "Mandalay,"
the Thane said, "the art is ours." Now he felt his father was just making fun of him.
"I know it's ours, but the Frey..." "No!"
Lothian held a hand up to stop him.
"Not the Frey. Ours."
He pointed at himself and then at Mandalay.
"Our family invented it. Your grandmother was the very first to use it. When she taught others, her lessons were always one-on-one or in small groups. The learning process was slow, random, inefficient. No one ever thought of formalizing the process until Pyridion came up with the idea. He built the academy using the art, the same way Fenelaus created Avampartha. He taught a whole generation of Frey, trained them to teach, and appointed them as instructors in his school. Grindel and Arion were both his students."
Mandalay couldn't care less about the traitor, but...
"He taught Grindel?"
"Oh, yes.
Ah. I don't recall. Have I ever met Peridian?
The Fane shook his head. He died before you were born. In fact, you could say your very existence is due to Peridian's death, which is why I find it so strange that you don't know about him. Mwandalay glanced again at Sain, feeling certain his father was purposely humiliating him. The Fane noticed and shook his head.
Trust me, this oversight is more embarrassing for me than for you. I should have mentioned him before.
Why? Who was he?
Mwandalay asked.
Your brother.
Chapter 6. Second Best.
That winter, seeds were planted. The army learned to fight. Smiths learned to forge. People learned what it felt like to live in a house, rather than a dirt-floored shack. And I learned to write. Human civilization was born under a blanket of snow, sheltered by walls of stone. The Book of Brin. The little window in the door at the base of the kype slid aside, exposing just a pair of eyes and part of a nose. As always, the sentinel said,
"State your business."
This was repeated in Frey. Why, Wraith had no idea.
"Back again to see Persephone. State your name and your business with Madame Koenig."
"You know my name."
"Refusal to answer will—" "Wraith! And because I want to speak with her."
"About what?"
"None of your business."
The little window snapped shut, but Wraith didn't leave. He waited. After living in Alenrist for 8 months, Wraith felt isolated even though he resided in a city of more people than he ever thought existed. Lately, he'd been blaming it on the snow. Drifts blocked the narrow streets, sealing people inside, discouraging communal gatherings. By spring, he realized it wasn't the snow. To make matters worse, he was always cold. For a man who grew up in a dirt house, heated only by wafers of dung, the grand marbled halls of the Rist were surprisingly chilly.
Dirt is wholesome, life-giving. Stone is just cold.
It took only a single winter in the Rist for Wraith to develop a nostalgia for his youth in Dorea. For the first time in recent memory, the weather had warmed and was downright hot. The snow was in full retreat, lingering only in deep shadows under bridges or tight alleyways. Birds were back. Buds popped, flowers sprouted, and Wraith wasn't pleased with how things had been going in the Rist. Wasn't his call. He was still just a chieftain of one. Two, if he included Malcolm, which he didn't. Now that Malcolm was back in the Rist, Wraith was less confident about the ex-slave's loyalties. There wasn't anything Malcolm said or did, but Wraith felt things had changed between them. A feeling in his gut, like a cold coming on. He started to lean against the bronze door that led to the inner sanctum of the fortress, but the sun had made it too hot to touch. He walked back across the bridge and peered over the edge. Long way down. He'd no idea how far, but red roofs, the size of cranberries, spilled at his feet. Out to the east, he could see all the way to the rocky highlands beyond the High Spear Valley, where his brothers had been slain. To the south, he could see the forks, where his father's body lay. While his village was much closer, the great dome blocked the view, and he couldn't see where his mother and sister had died. His village was right underfoot, but hidden from him. He was surrounded by death in every direction except one. Returning to the door, he beat on the bronze again. The window slid back once more.
"Yes?"
asked the eyes and nose.
Still waiting? Did you have an appointment?
A what? Just tell Persephone I'm here, will you?
And why does that matter?
Because she's a friend of mine.
And?
And what?
Wraith asked.
That's what I'm asking. Madam Keenick is a very busy woman. If I can't inform her of what this meeting is pertaining to, I don't see how I can report it at all.
It's not a meeting. I would just like to talk to her.
That's what a meeting is, sir. Is the topic of your conversation a matter of wrist security? Is that why you are refusing to divulge its nature? If so, I can assure you that I am quite trusted by the administration of the Citadel, and you should have no concerns about revealing any information to me.
Wraith didn't understand most of the words, even though he was certain they were in runic.
Listen, I just want to say hello.
If that's all, I can pass that information to her. You don't need to bother the Keenig.
I also want to see how she's doing, okay?
So, this is a cordial call. A purely social visit.
Yeah, whatever.
Please wait.
The little window slid shut again. Wraith backed away from the heat-radiating door, wondering if the interior was roasting. That might account for the interaction. The guard's brains were baked. Once again, he went out on the bridge, but this time he looked up. The Kype was a building of solid stone, as high as the Verinthian. It had but one entrance, and its only windows were narrow slits near the top. This made the Kype, and everything beyond it, the most secured portion of the fortress. Anyone attacking would need to cross the Granford Bridge, break into the big gates, fight through the lower courtyard, climb the winding ramp, then battle through the narrow city streets. And that would just get them to the fortress proper, where another smaller wall and an additional set of bronze gates waited. Behind them was the upper courtyard, which housed the barracks, training fields, tannery, kitchens, smithies, and livestock pens. Above that, and up a steep, narrow staircase, was the domed Verinthian. An invading force would need to climb up that death trap of a staircase, around the Verinthian's series of terraces and balconies, just to reach the long corbel bridge where Wraith now stood. Given that the famed Spyrock, that sky-piercing watchtower of stone and glass, was on the far side of the Kype, and accessed by another bridge, it was the most isolated place in the Wrist complex. So far, after more than 8 months of trying, Wraith had never made it farther than where he now stood. He hadn't been able to get inside the Kype, never made it past its bronze door. The little window opened once more.
Madam Keenick is not available at this time.
Before Wraith could say anything, the little window slammed shut, this time followed by a metal-on-metal snap. In a field of grass, scarred by patches of worn dirt, 4 dozen men beat each other with sticks. A few others used metal swords, the more advanced ones, the quick learners, but most swung hickory imitations at each other's heads. Wraith could tell the trainees were getting better, since wood-to-wood cracks outnumbered soft, fleshy slaps. In addition, the curses and genuine screams were rare. That morning, rapid staccato clacks carried across the training field, punctuated by the occasional hoot of success.
"See her?" Malcolm asked, even before Wraith was completely down the stairs.
"I think she's taking a bath."
Malcolm and Suri basked in the sun at the bottom of the stairs, reclining with their legs extended on the grass. The two looked like a pair of lizards basking in the heat. Malcolm craned his head back to squint at Wraith.
"Turned away again? Did you tell them you're a chieftain?"
"They know that."
Wraith sat in the light alongside Suri. It felt good to soak up the sun, to feel it on his face.
"Never know how much you appreciate something until it's gone."
Are you sure?
Wraith nodded, while watching the practice field, where the closest combatants were Farmer Whedon and one of the younger Gula. Pride prevented the older northern men from training with the Frey, but they sent their boys and young men, who likely repeated everything they learned when they returned home. Everyone wore nothing but breech clouts, their skin slick and shiny with sweat. He could tell the better fighters by the number of grass blades stuck to the backs of their opponents.
"He's doing it on purpose," Wraith said.
"He?"
"Nephron," Suri offered.
She had her eyes closed, hands folded on her chest, as if she were dead.
Malcolm glanced at the girl, then back at Wraith.
"Nephron was there?"
"No. Well, I can't actually say. All I ever see are eyes and a nose, so maybe. But I'm sure it's by his orders. Trying to keep me away from her. He doesn't like the competition."
"You think he's..." "What? You think Nephron is romantically interested in Persephone?"
Wraith smirked.
"You are the one who once told me Frey and humans weren't so different. Remember? I'm not saying it's impossible. Just wondering what makes you think he's interested."
Suri answered for Wraith.
"It's because Nephron raises his fur whenever Wraith gets too close."
"Raises his fur?"
Malcolm chuckled.
"Like a badger on a fresh kill. Gets all protective and tries to scare off anything that gets too close."
When Malcolm chuckled again, she added,
"I wouldn't go laughing at a badger. No sense of humor. None at all. Trust me on that."
"Every time I see Persephone, he's there. I can't get the woman alone. They sit together at every public meal, at every council meeting."
"He finishes her sentences now. Have you noticed?"
Suri said, looking up at him while shielding her eyes from the sun. Wraith hadn't, but he'd seen little of Persephone of late. Most people weren't allowed inside the Kype. Persephone's personal attendants, such as Moya, Padera, and Bryn, were among the few that had access. Suri could get in because she and Arion shared a room behind the bronze door. As for Wraith, he only saw Persephone during the large, noisy, obligatory, and increasingly infrequent council meetings held in the Verinthian.
"He keeps her imprisoned in that tower, like a dragon guarding its hoard." "She's just busy," Malcolm said. "You forget, she's the Keenig of the 10 clans. If you add the Anstaria to that number, it means she's in control of the whole frontier. I've heard she has constant meetings, all day, and late into the night."
"With who?"
"All kinds of people. Civic leaders from here, who are still fearful of runes in their midst. Messengers from all the rune villages. And Frey commanders keeping her posted on developments from as far away as Ervenon."
"What's Ervenon?"
"Another fortress like this, but north of here. All the Anstaria outposts now fall under her control because they recognize Nephron as head of the Anstaria and rightful Lord of the Wrist, and he acknowledges her rule as the Keenig."
He pointed at the Frey instructors, moving through the combatants, holding their own little sticks and shouting instructions, encouragements, and insults.
"And then there are these fellows here. Persephone has them reporting on the training process. And there are the supply train organizers, and the quartermasters giving reports on growth, field rotations, and forecasted yields, not to mention the Frey who keep the Wrist functioning. I've heard the wells are running low. And, of course, she has to listen to grievances in the High Court of the Carol."
"I have grievances," Wraith said.
Malcolm plucked a long blade of grass from near the bottom step.
"But not pertaining to official business. The things I'm talking about are complaints about new regulations or unfair treatment."
"I'm being treated unfairly. She's my friend. I shouldn't need official business. I used to be able to just walk over and see her."
Malcolm shrugged with an apologetic smile.
Times change.
Suri sat up and addressed Wraith.
I've told you before, I can get you in.
Wraith looked at her, and she smiled. Her grin was more than an offer to escort him through the door. She was hinting at greater consequences. Suri had spoken of her trip to the land of the dwarfs. Not all of it. He could tell some parts were too raw to get near. Her reluctance was similar to Wraith's silence about his family and life in Dorea. Certain moments were avoided, hinted at, but not trod upon. Not from a lack of trust, but a reluctance to walk over old graves. She told him enough to know that, if so inclined, Suri could reduce the kype to rubble or melt the bronze door to an insignificant puddle. This was what her grin meant, and that smile was accompanied by a mischievous twinkle in her eyes that said it would be as much fun for her as it would be advantageous for him. He smiled, but shook his head.
If I really need to get in, I could. Frost or flood would pop the hinges off that door, or I could just ask Bryn or Moya to arrange an audience.
My way would be more fun.
Suri wiggled her eyebrows.
Arion wouldn't like it, Wraith said. You know she wouldn't.
I'd put it back, the mystic said.
Wraith had no idea what it was she planned to put back. The door, maybe. Knowing her, and judging from the size of that grin, it might be the entire front-facing wall of the kype.
So, why don't you?
Malcolm asked Wraith. Why not arrange for an audience?
Because I don't want an audience with the Kingnig. I want to see Seth, and I don't want to see her if she doesn't want to see me.
He pulled his legs up and sighed.
I've been to that door a couple dozen times over the winter. Everyone knows. I'm sure she's heard by now. But even if she hasn't, why has she never come looking for me?
And don't tell me she's busy.
No one is that busy.
The sound of cracking sticks diminished as most of the pair stopped fighting. Everyone's attention was drawn to the center of the field where no grass grew, and two combatants faced off.
What's going on? Wraith asked.
Tesh and Sebek, Malcolm replied.
Again?
The kid's determined.
Wraith backed up the steps to see over the heads of the sweaty men gathering in a ring around Sebek and Tesh. The two used actual swords, no shields, and were naked to the waist, like everyone else. As always, Sebek held both his swords, Nagon and Tabor. Tesh had his own pair of roan-made iron short swords. Over the course of 8 months, Tesh had excelled at combat training. The boy, who had marked his 16th birthday just 2 months before, had thrown himself into learning everything he could about fighting. He was out before dawn, and came back to his bed late each night, falling asleep as soon as his head hit the mattress. At least twice he never made it to the bed, and Wraith found him asleep on the floor or table, with a half-eaten meal beside him. All the exercise and ample food had turned the one-time cadaverous whelp into a lean, muscular lad. Still lanky, still not as tall as he would likely one day be, Tesh was already well on his way toward his goal of mastering the disciplines of the Galantians.
Up for another beating!
Sebek grinned, spinning Tabor in his grip. Tesh didn't reply. He was crouched, blades up, concentrating, staring into Sebek's eyes. No one fought Sebek except Tesh. The fray didn't teach. He humiliated. He also injured. Everyone knew Sebek was talented enough to avoid injuring his opponents, but he was easily irritated by weak competition and showed his disappointment by drawing blood. During one match, a terrified farmer from Menahan started crying, and Sebek responded by cutting off the man's little finger.
No one fought Sebek after that. No one, except Tesh. The lad desperately wanted to beat the master. The desire had turned into an obsession. The kid invited Sebek to come at him, and Sebek obliged. His two blades looked more like 10 as they whirled in circles, criss-crossing their course in a weaving pattern that left only streaks. The blades themselves moved too fast to be seen. When Tesh's swords collided with Sebek's, the sound was the crash of metal waves upon a metal shore. There were sparks. Wraith never saw any other colliding blades, spark. He had witnessed the Galantians sparring with each other. Vorath and Tekchin frequently held grudge matches, but their clashes didn't kick sparks. When Tesh fought Sebek, it always produced a light show. The boy fell back. He always did. An onslaught from Sebek was a force of nature that couldn't be resisted or contained. Wraith remembered the one time he'd battled Sebek, and it had been nothing like this. The Frey had calculatingly probed and then disarmed Wraith with his bare hand. Tesh was genuinely trying to win. He managed to catch strokes he couldn't see, deflecting blind thrusts and ducking swipes even before they were made. Tesh looked like he was reading the Frey's mind. And still, Sebek was way out ahead, planning 3 strokes in advance, knowing not only that Tesh would manage to block, but how he would block. Sebek formulated attacks to counter Tesh's moves before the lad even thought of them. All 48 men stood in the field, intently watching what was sure to be the most amazing display of combat any of them had ever seen. The spectators winced, gasped, and cringed, always after the fact, after disaster almost happened. Reactions were too slow to keep pace. By Mara's name, the kid is really good. Wraith wondered how such a thing was possible after only a year. No, not just a year. He's Duraean. That kid's been fighting his whole life. He remembered how Tesh had brandished a dagger the day they first met, and how the boy had tripped him numerous times when the two sparred on the beaches of Dol Tyr. Wraith had thought Tesh was entertaining. He'd no idea what the kid was capable of. He might have been able to kill me, even back then. It was like I was playing with a lion cub, and now it outweighs me. Wraith never saw it happen. Everything was too quick. He heard it, though, an off note, a clang instead of a ping, and one of Tesh's swords flew from his hands. Sebek didn't let up. He attacked with unrelenting aggression. Tesh couldn't block both of Sebek's swords with just his one. The boy caught the first, but the second came across his open side. Sebek was going to exact payment for the fight. He was going to cut Tesh across the chest, leave a mark his opponent wouldn't forget. But that didn't happen. Tesh slapped the blade away with his bare hand. He did it 3 times before Sebek stopped the fight and lowered his blades. He nodded. Better. The crowd of sweat-slick men erupted into cheers and shouts of jubilation. Sebek hadn't been beaten. The match wasn't even close to a draw. Disarming Tesh counted as a victory, and the kid hadn't mounted even a single offense in the whole match. But he had held his own, and for the men on that field, it was a victory beyond any of their dreams. Sebek flipped Tesh's lost sword into the air with his foot and struck it with a sharp swing from his own blade, sending the weapon spinning at the kid. Tesh caught it by its handle and slammed both blades into their scabbards. "Well done, Teklor," Sebek said. As if the contest had been the finale, training for that day ended when everyone rushed to clap Tesh on the back. Wraith turned to Malcolm. "What's it mean? What Sebek called Tesh?"
"Teklor," Malcolm said. "It means swift of hand."
Or just Swift Hand, I suppose.
Great. The kid's going to be impossible to live with now, Wraith grumbled.
Malcolm nodded,